movies, writer, director, composer, designer, location scout, Yodorovsky is also the star. We see him first in the film as a black-clad gunman, later as a beatific monk in a fractured, visually exorbitant narrative, which combines incredible grotesque violence with broad pantomimic comedy and mind-boggling mystical solemnity taken from a range of arcane philosophical sources. At this point in time, Yodorovsky has one other feature film to his credit. It's titled Fandolis. Fandolis had caused a considerable stir when screened in Mexico in 1968, but Yodorovsky had no plans for a Mexican release of El Topo. El Topo was a picture, after all, that took on the archetypal American movie genre, the Western. Yodorovsky, in making the film, had not only used technicians from Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, he'd also used standing sets from another runaway Hollywood production shot in Mexico. And he'd even gone to the trouble of copying a John Wayne costume in which to dress the film's double man gunfighter. Of course, you've seen it. That's the man with no arms carrying the map in the legs. What's more, the film as a whole seems to foretell Yodorovsky's arrival in the United States, his stepping off of that plane in New York. It takes place in a desert space that seems to be a hazy hinterland between the USA and Mexico. Moreover, while the town that Yodorovsky, with his seven-year-old son, arrive in the opening reel, is unquestionably inhabited by Mexican peasants, the town in which Yodorovsky ends up in at the end and in which he sets fire to himself, though in many ways it's a mirror to that of the beginning, seeing as how when Yodorovsky's El Topo is finished with it, it streaks to a heaving with the dead. It seems a more developed town, more northerly in aspect. In other words, it seems to be a town which is closer to, if not on the other side of, the American border. And so it was that Yodorovsky, with record producer Alan Douglas, arranged for a number of private screenings of this film, El Topo, in the New York Museum of Modern Art. Among that half of the audience who didn't walk out at one such screening was a guy named Ben Barinholtz. Barinholtz was the owner of a rundown 600-seater cinema just north of Greenwich Village called the Albion. At this point in time, the Albion was presenting one of its periodic festivals of avant-garde film. And looking at the hippie audiences that films by John Lennon and Yoko Ono especially were attracting, Barinholtz decided to try El Topo out in the cinema. The screening time he picked was midnight. This was a slot designed to appear to that hippie audience, to the counterculture, on several fronts. Not the least of which was that if you were in paid employment, that was the time you really should be in bed, waiting to get up for your next working day. All that was outside the theatre was a handwritten sign which described El Topo in this witching hour slot as a film too heavy to be shown in any other way. On the 18th of December 1970, El Topo received its first public screening at the Albion, and 6.5 months later, with still not even a poster for the film on its frontage, the Albion was still playing El Topo, 12 o'clock during weekdays, 1 a.m. on the weekends. Over that six-month period of the Albion, El Topo became the central artifact of the East Coast hippie scene. By January 1971, full houses were a regular phenomenon, and limousines outside the Elgin were dispensing the likes of Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda, everyone eager for a ticket. Meanwhile, inside the cinema, the air was thick with marijuana smoke. The atmosphere was more that of a concert than a screening, and indeed, El Topo was playing in what was commonly referred to as the concert slot. Rather than have a supporting programme, the picture would often be preceded by discos featuring the likes of Janis Joplin and hippie bands like Pearl. El Topo's flamboyant and schizophrenic score, which mixes tantric chanting with shrieking Sergio Leone-like horns and soothing ethnic pipes, all composed by Yodorovsky, made perfect sense to any who were already wowed by, for example, the sitars of Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones, or Brian Gysin's Master Musicians of Jujuka. Later, there'd be a gatefold release of the soundtrack of El Topo on the Beatles label, Apple, than even being an album of music inspired by the soundtrack to El Topo. And as for the contents of the film, well, it's an exorbitant mix of mysticism, rage, and showmanship on Jodorowsky's part, seeing the cinematic equivalent of the descent found in the counterculture's music. There have been previous feature films which have captured the imaginations of a hippie audience, of course. Many a Tower of Acid have been dropped before screenings of Fantasia or 2001 Space Odyssey. But here in El Topo, for the first time it seemed, was a feature not appropriated from the mainstream, but one which had come direct to the subculture. Like some psychedelic Ark of the Covenant, within which are housed tablets of alternative truth, it had been carried out of the desert into New York by this wild man Moses, this Jodorowsky, the crazy haired guy who'd just seen the trailer there, who midway through the film proves his allegiance to this countercultural audience by ingesting a hallucinogenic beetle. By May 1971, mainstream critics finally began to take notice of El Topo, this phenomenon which had circumvented so many of the normal mechanisms of cinema success. The fact that the reaction of those critics was either one of bemusement or of disdain only underlined for El Topo's devotees what Pauline Kael referred to as the El Topo freaks, that here, finally, was a film for us, not them. Also in May 1971, Jodorowsky and Adam Douglas showed El Topo at the Cannes Film Festival. It had to be shown out of competition. The Mexican government had refused to sanction it as the country's official entry. But El Topo proved to be the festival's unofficial winner. There was a special banquet thrown for Jodorowsky, and Dennis Hopper, who was also there, proclaimed Jodorowsky to be the filmmaker of the century. One person who failed to see El Topo at Cannes, but who was at Cannes looking for films for his manager to buy and distribute in America, was John Lennon. In the event, Lennon saw El Topo back at the Elgin in New York, where his and Yoko's experimental short had generated El Topo's first audiences. Immediately on seeing the film, Lennon urged his manager, Alan Klein, not only to buy the rights of El Topo, but also to sign Jodorowsky up to an exclusive contract. Again, Jodorowsky the filmmaker merging with Jodorowsky as some kind of rock star figure. The immediate effect of this deal with Jodorowsky was that El Topo was withdrawn from the Elgin. Tickets were still like gold dust, the film was still selling out, but Alan Klein had big plans for Jodorowsky, plans which included placing him head to head with the biggest and best that Hollywood itself had offered. In November 1971, El Topo received its official New York opening, on Broadway, amid all the glamour of mainstream New York. In preparation for this opening, Alan Klein struck the trailer that you just saw, already proclaiming it a masterpiece of cinema. And also purchased billboard space on Times Square at $60,000 a month. Nearly four times, indeed, the amount that El Topo had made of the Elgin per month. Jodorowsky, in the meantime, was proclaiming himself the Cecil B. DeMille of the avant-garde. In fact, the next film he was going to make, he told us, would actually star Cecil B. DeMille's ghost. And among those actors willing to play alongside that ghost, clamouring indeed to be in Jodorowsky's follow-up to El Topo, were Dennis Hopper, Peter Fonda, John Lennon, George Harrison, Frank Zappa, the hippie activist Jerry Rubin, and even one actor offered to die on screen for Jodorowsky, if only Jodorowsky would cast him. As for what this follow-up to El Topo would be about, well, according to Jodorowsky, perhaps it would be a film in which guns fired blood, not bullets. Perhaps it would be a film shot from a plane 10,000 metres above its performance, so that the camera, to quote Jodorowsky, could record many pasts and many presents and many futures at the same time. Or maybe it would be a musical comedy scripted in collaboration with the spirit of the horse ridden by the founder of the Rosicrucian Order. Or maybe it would be a children's film, a pirate movie, another genre like the Western that Jodorowsky believed that Hollywood had destroyed, in which the buildings of New York replaced the ocean waves, and a 200-kilo woman's liver would be the heroine. Or maybe it would be a gangster movie in which criminals stage an assault upon a mystic mountain. At this moment for Jodorowsky, nothing seemed impossible. At this moment, it seemed almost that Jodorowsky could transform the entire face of American film. Because whatever this follow-up was going to be, it was going to be made with a Hollywood-sized budget. El Topo would cost maybe $400,000 to make. The Holy Mountain, the film that eventually did follow El Topo in 1973, will cost maybe $4 million. Some of the money that Jodorowsky was given to this film, was given to make this film, he would pass on to filmmakers in Mexico to encourage them to become little Alejandros in his wake. For Jodorowsky, in fact, the $4 million he'd been given to make The Holy Mountain was nowhere near enough. For him, rightfully, all the resources of the USA should be at his disposal. To make the picture I want, the director declared during a break in the Holy Mountain's production, I think I'd need $10 million, $20 million, Fort Knox. Now, this is maybe a good point at which to backtrack a little. To the 1950s, in fact, and the decline in cinema attendances in America, as elsewhere, thanks to the popularity of television. There was a new appetite for staying at home for one's entertainment in the 1950s, and this freed up a sector of the population that was emerging anyway, but which for cinema became a newly important market force. I'm thinking, of course, of the teenager. The teenager had no wish to sit quietly at home with the family, and it was hungry anyway for that kind of rowdy, sensationalist entertainment that TV was not going to provide. So in order to prize the dollars from the hands of this new audience, genres were invented and reinvented in the image of the teenager. Rock and roll movies vied with revivals of old horror stories which had been dosed up with sex and violence, and which had titles like I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, and were branded by conventional critics for sadists only. At first, the producers of this kind of movie were mainly low-budget chances. For example, Roger Corman in America or Hammer Films in the UK. And Hollywood breathed a collective sigh of relief when in 1965, 20th Century Fox's The Sound of Music proved that a family audience for wholesome movies still existed. In that year, Sound of Music grossed an incredible $150 million. And in response, the Hollywood majors put into production a slate of lavish musicals which was matched on the exhibition side by cinema builders putting in train an ambitious program of new cinemas. Unfortunately, all the movies that The Sound of Music inspired, Sweet Charity, Star, Dr. Dolittle, Hello Dolly, Paint Your Wagon, Goodbye Mr. Chips, failed miserably. They failed so miserably that the executives who commissioned them found themselves out of a job. And into their seats slipped a new generation of studio executives, younger, more willing to court this new youth audience. In 1969, Columbia Films backed Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda's Easy Rider, a film that was financed largely from the profits of the Monkees TV series. Easy Rider was a huge success, and though it was a motorcycle movie, it seemed to draw as much upon the underground experimental cinema that was playing in such New York cinemas as the Elgin, as on the exploitation movies that Hopper, Fonda, and Easy Rider's co-star Jack Nicholson had all appeared in for the aforementioned Roger Corman. The film had a compilation rock soundtrack. At that time, the approach was almost unprecedented. And it recalled more than anything else the musical score of Kenneth Anger's underground film, Scorpio Rising. And as for the LSD trip that was shot by Dennis Hopper on 16mm cameras, and which sits right in the middle of Easy Rider. Well, that quite simply looked like an avant-garde short that had been dropped neatly into the centre of this Columbia-backed film. To put it another way, by the end of the 1960s, we'd arrived at a very topsy-turvy time cinema-wise. The so-called secret flicks, the despised genres that were so beloved by early film cultists and underground filmmakers, the horror films, cheap and cheesy movies, sexy and violent films, these were being embraced now by the major studios. Moreover, the avant-garde films that those underground filmmakers who were watching these secret flicks themselves were making also seemed to be pressing on the mainstream, as Easy Rider evidenced. To get a sense of the disarray in which American cinema found itself as a result, one need only think of Deep Throat, the 1972 porno movie in which Linda Lovelace plays a woman with a vagina in her sarcophagus. This film, despite its hardcore content, became a fashionable couples movie in New York as elsewhere. And in response, the next feature made by Deep Throat's director, Gerald Damiano, would be The Devil in Miss Jones, a film which plays like some infernal mating of the hardcore sex flick with the most highfalutin European art cinema. And this was the situation over which Jodorowsky established his weird mastery with El Topo. El Topo was a movie that combined the exploitation excesses of the secret flicks with the farthest reaches of the countercultural underground cinema. Single-handedly, El Topo made tenable the midnight slot that was created for it to play in. As the 70s proceeded, it would be this slot that would make cult hits of the likes of Night of the Living Dead, Dark Star, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and would make cult directors of movie makers like John Waters, Russ Meyer, and David Lynch. But it would be Jodorowsky's next movie, his first American-backed film, The Holy Mountain, which would finally tear down the walls of establishment cinema. Potential distributors Universal offered Jodorowsky $500,000 if only he would tone down the mystical script he had written for it. Jodorowsky refused. After all, the very plot of The Holy Mountain, which involves the scaling of a magic mountain and the wresting of the secret of immortality from the nine sages that sit at its peak, was a metaphor for what Jodorowsky, with the backing of Alan Klein, was about to do to Hollywood, or Hollywood, the Holy Mountain of Los Angeles. Except, of course, the Holy Mountain brought no walls crashing down. It would, in fact, prove to be a conspicuous disaster. None of the stars who'd initially expressed an interest in the project took part. Dennis Hopper was immersed in the endless re-edit of his follow-up to Easy Rider, the last movie, which, like El Topo, was another countercultural updating of the Western. Jodorowsky, in fact, helped edit the last movie with Hopper at one point. Peter Fonda, in the meantime, had taken a different route by making his own rather less apocalyptic Western, The Hired Hand, his first movie as a director. And John Lennon turned down the central role in the film of The Thief after Jodorowsky insisted, forgive me for this, that Lennon would have to have his arsehole washed on screen. So the cast instead included the flotsam that Jodorowsky had gathered about him since El Topo had awarded him this American fame. Jodorowsky's idea was to bring this cast of ne'er-do-wells to a state of enlightenment as the movie progressed. Early on, we see Jodorowsky, who in this movie plays the master alchemist, transform shit, the thief's excrement, into gold. And this was what he intended to do to his cast, too. In the Holy Mountain's credit sequence, we actually see Jodorowsky, apparently in character as the master alchemist, shaving the heads and stripping the clothes from two minor members of the cast. And when we actually get into the movie proper, we only ever see them with bald heads. It's basically Jodorowsky, the alchemist, but also Jodorowsky as Jodorowsky inducting these disciples into a new way of thinking. But as the shoot of The Holy Mountain progressed, Jodorowsky found himself becoming disillusioned with the people that he was trying to direct. In Mexico City, he fired the film's on-set guru, see credits like Prudential Manager. Well, Holy Mountain was going to have a credit which read Guru. This was a chap named Oscar Icazo, who has invented this system of meditation which consisted of sleep deprivation and taking lots of hallucinogenic drugs. And by the time Jodorowsky reached the end of the movie, Jodorowsky's films are shot in sequence. And this end of the movie involved a gang of super criminals climbing the mountain itself. He discovered that on this mountain, his cast had not become newly spiritual. Rather, they were arguing over who was going to have the biggest bread roll for breakfast. So instead of shooting the scripted final scene, in which the super criminals are seen to levitate in their new position of power after taking over from the old immortals, Jodorowsky simply and rather superbly orders the zoom back camera. The camera does zoom back, it reveals the film crew, it reveals the pretense of everything we've been watching. The actors, like the audience, are left looking a little bewildered, and the film stops dead in its tracks. Jodorowsky was proud of The Holy Mountain. It is a film even more immersed in occult systems than El Topo. It's a film also that comes complete with an audacious quadraphonic soundtrack. And it's a film which at times is conspicuously, intoxicatingly lavish as any of those superannuated 60s musicals that it set out to replace. Alan Klein, however, was not amused. And even Alan Douglas, if you remember El Topo's initial American distributor, complained that Jodorowsky didn't pull it back for the kids. Admittedly, The Holy Mountain did play in one cinema in New York for 16 months straight. But Alan Klein never even bothered to open it in Los Angeles. Didn't give it any kind of national release whatsoever. And soon he was allowing the movie only to be shown if it was double billed with El Topo. Virtually a five-hour program, which no cinema was going to take. What Klein wanted Jodorowsky to do next was to make a sex movie, an adaptation of Pauline Reage's S&M novel, The Story of Eau. Avant-garde filmmaker Kenneth Anger had tried and failed to adapt the same book in the 1950s. And Jodorowsky talked for a while, rather half-heartedly, of an opening scene in which the universe is discovered by a camera penetrating a giant vagina and passing up the ovaries, accompanied by the chanting of 100 monks. But at heart, and I think maybe this that very story suggests this, at heart, Jodorowsky didn't want to make this movie. He knew that despite everything that Alan Klein had said, Klein was merely another money man, a manager determined to squeeze him for more commercial product. And so, with heavy heart and the rights to both El Topo and Holy Mountain still in Alan Klein's grasp, Jodorowsky left America, never professionally to return. Jodorowsky next resettled in Paris, and he spent a frustrating 3 years working mainly on an adaptation of Frank Herbert's hippie science fiction Bible, Dune. This book had been published in 1966, and you could spot it, for example, under the arm of Jack Nicholson at the Cannes Film Festival in 1971. It was a very modish book. Jodorowsky's plan was to make a 3-hour, 70mm epic with financial backing of $20 million from both America and France. For a time, the money was in place. So Jodorowsky gathered about him a technical team that included the Swiss artist H.R. Geiger, French illustrator Jean-Mobius Giraud, and the designer of Dark Star, Dan O'Bannon. He also had casting discussions with David Carradine from the Kung Fu TV series. Jodorowsky claimed that Kung Fu TV series was inspired by El Topo. He also talked with Orson Welles, Gloria Swanson, and Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali had an ambition to become the highest paid actor in cinema history at this time. So Jodorowsky agreed to pay him $100,000 an hour, except he'd only employ him for 1 hour. And so he'd shoot Dali from as many different angles as possible, and then he would build a robot of Salvador Dali, which would be used in any sequence which didn't involve close-ups. Jodorowsky worked on this project for 3 years, 1975 to 1978. But by 78, he made the harsh discovery that such flights of fancy as this would no longer be indulged as they were at the beginning of the 70s. The Americans withdrew their finance. And in 1977, rather than Jodorowsky's mystical love generation science fiction, we had Star Wars, a film made on a comparable budget to that proposed for Dune. Now, the irony about that, of course, is that at one point, Dune would have been considered a real possibility because of the new kind of cinema made possible by this new youth audience. But by the late 70s, the target demographic had dropped again. Star Wars would go on to reinvent cinema for an even younger, more childish mind, a mind looking for cinema as a roller coaster ride. Well, just to add insult to injury, the trend for space operas that Star Wars began resulted in 1979 in another hit movie, Alien. Alien was the baby of one Dan O'Bannon, working in concert with H.R. Geiger and Jean Moebius Jureau, who have been brought together by Jodorowsky to make Dune. And so the disappointments went on. For a moment in the early 1970s, Jodorowsky appeared to be the envoy who would merge the underground with mainstream film. For a moment, Jodorowsky appeared to find a route by which to run mysticism and the wayward illogicality of dream headlong into cinema, the most industrial, the most materialist, the most level-headed and money-oriented of art forms. But by the late 70s, no more. In 1979, Jodorowsky accepted a contract to adapt Reginald Campbell's Indian adventure novel, Houlon of the Elephants, I kid you not, from French producer Eric Rochard. Here at last, Jodorowsky was a chance to make that children's movie he long wanted to make. What he wanted to do with this movie, that would eventually be called Tusk, was construct a poem of love addressed to India. Would attack the easy anthropomorphism of Walt Disney. Disney is another hate figure of Jodorowsky's. And would take its central character, an elephant, and turn it into a revolutionary hero, a mystical animal who inspires love, devotion, and revolution in India. Unfortunately, the film went entirely wrong. Jodorowsky promised $5 million, but the producer acquired that $5 million and pocketed most of it himself. Variety called the resulting movie a two-ton turkey. Alan Klein, Jodorowsky's old manager, mocked the movie as unreleasable, and the film was only released in France. I do have a clip of the film that I'd like to show you, just to get a sense of the way in which Jodorowsky was still trying to import magic into the films he was making.
Thank you.
Accepted that times have changed irreversibly. We don't experience the elephant, he said in 1980, we experience the Cadillac. His next film, Santa Sangre, wouldn't be made until a decade later, and this time Jodorowsky would use a genre in a much less confrontational way than in the way he used the Western in El Topo. Taking for its basis the Mexican serial killer Gojo Cardenas, Santa Sangre used the sense of unreality is anyway inherent in the horror movie. That sense of the surreal that made horror the favoured viewing of many an underground filmmaker before Jodorowsky, to fashion what in many ways was a triumphant return to the cinematic arena for Jodorowsky. Combining Psycho and The Invisible Man with the surface milieu of films that Jodorowsky found so liberating, and also filling the cast just as he had done with Bando Elise, El Topo and The Holy Mountain, with members of his family, Jodorowsky made of Santa Sangre a film that was unmistakably his. Many scenes in it are as strong and as strange in their imagery as anything in his 1970s successes. You'll find in that movie, and some of you will have seen it again, an elephant burial, very strange sequence, also the central image of the double person, an armless mother whose arms are provided by her son who stands behind him, passing his limbs through the sleeves of her dress. And also many scenes of explicit violence, which, unlike those found in films by other filmmakers, are much less a way to demonstrate the realism of the film, to demonstrate the flesh and blood reality, than a way to topple the movie over into the most strange, unreal, fantastical passages. In Santa Sangre, one of its main characters, Orgo, is played by Guy Stockwell. Guy Stockwell is the brother of Dean Stockwell. You may know Dean Stockwell from Blue Velvet, Quantum Leap, etc. And Dean Stockwell had been another of those counterculturalists of the early 70s who had courted Jodorowsky back then. You'll find Dean Stockwell in Dennis Hopper's The Last Movie, for example. Actually, for the part of Orgo, Jodorowsky wanted to cast Dennis Hopper. But Dennis Hopper asked for too much money, and Jodorowsky couldn't anyway understand why, in the 80s, Hopper had directed Colors, a movie which celebrates, of all things, the Los Angeles police force. This is a long way from the dissenting days of the early 70s. So, yes, Santa Sangre was a success, but it was a fleeting one. It was a success because it was a film taken up by the horror fraternity. Santa Sangre was produced by the brother of Italian horror maestro Dario Argento. But Jodorowsky had no wish to pursue horror as a career path. Santa Sangre's notoriety did lead to talk of a sequel to El Topo, Sunday El Topo. It also led to the possibility, on the death of Jodorowsky's friend Federico Fellini, of Jodorowsky using some of the money from Fellini's estate to make a live-action version of Fellini's comic strip, Trip to Tulum. It's a graphic novel in which Jodorowsky himself actually appears as a character. But for a director such as Jodorowsky, many of these promises were again pie in the sky. Opportunities were still extremely limited. Until in 1990, an offer came which Jodorowsky accepted, and you'll get the picture by now, inevitably, disaster ensued. The Mexican novelist Roberta Dominguez D, who was the wife of the veteran Polish producer Alexander Salkin, had long been promised a Valentine from her husband in the form of a movie adaptation of her novel The Rainbow Thief. Being of Mexican origin, Roberta Dominguez had a nostalgia for Jodorowsky's career in Mexico. And in the light of Santa Sangre, with Jodorowsky, a current name once more, Berta Dominguez chose Jodorowsky to helm her film. contract which Jodorowsky signed stipulated that there would be no sex and no violence. And this was a loophole that Jodorowsky was quick to exploit, it didn't forbid was the improvisation of animals. And a major row ensued between Jodorowsky and his producers while working at Shepperton in the UK over a rat that Jodorowsky had written into the script. The producers said that building a mechanical rat, which would do everything that Jodorowsky had suggested, would cost too much. Jodorowsky said, the rat will improvise. And a huge argument ensued about the notion of having Peter O'Toole, Omar Sharif, having to improvise around the random actions of a pet rat, which resulted in Jodorowsky assaulting one of the producers in order to encourage him, and again I quote, to understand my images. Another producer was drafted in to act as an intermediary between Jodorowsky and those producers who were no longer talking to Jodorowsky on set. Others were employed whose sole job it was to ensure that Jodorowsky injected no disreputable material. And Peter O'Toole, who stars in the film as an insane tarot-reading heir to the fortune of Christopher Lee, Peter O'Toole is living in the sewers of Paris, was given a puppet dog which he himself manipulated rather than the rat which had caused so much trouble in the first place. The resulting film, The Rainbow Thief, does in many ways speak to Jodorowsky's other movies. Again, characteristic of Jodorowsky's films, it maps out a strange relationship between Peter O'Toole's master and the thieving servant played by Omar Sharif. And there are many images which rhyme with Jodorowsky's other films too. But refused carte blanche, his customary carte blanche, Jodorowsky seemed to make up for this lack of freedom in certain areas with a surfeit of whimsy and clowning, which in other films is just one aspect of his work. And frankly, the results are at times pretty embarrassing. Variety, again, would describe The Rainbow Thief as possessing a mood closer to Mary Poppins than to El Topo. The film does bring off one genuinely mystical coup at its climax. The sewers are flooded. Peter O'Toole loses his puppet dog, which is a replacement for a real wolfhound that he lost in those sewers 5 years before. And Peter O'Toole drowns himself as a result. And the following day, Omar Sharif watches as miraculously the real dog, the dog lost 5 years ago, is flushed out of those tunnels. Whether it's a reincarnation of O'Toole, come back to serve Sharif in the skin of this puppet, is never explained. But by this single moment, Jodorowsky seems virtually enthralled to the whims of Berta Dominguez Dee, the writer whose film this really was. This was a film hardly intended ever to be seen by anyone. It was simply a love token from her husband to her. Berta Dominguez is even given a grand death scene in a sequence which draws on Jodorowskian imagery, but at the same time feels woefully prostituted to the vanity of those back in the film. And I've got that sequence for you now.
Ha ha ha!
Thank you.